Good day, everybody, and welcome back to the Oil Ground Up podcast with me, Tony Greer, editor of The Morning Navigator. In today's episode, we welcome Dr. Anas Alhaji, managing partner at Energy Outlook Advisors. As a reminder, this episode of the Oil Ground Up podcast is produced in partnership with Clear Commodity Network. You can find this episode and the rest of our network content at clearcommodity.net. Please be sure to like, subscribe, and share the content. Good day, listeners of the Oil Ground Up podcast. This is your host, Tony Greer, speaking. I'm here with Dr. Anas Alhaji, managing partner at Energy Outlook Advisors. Dr. Anas, thanks for joining me today. How are you, sir?
Oh, thank you. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Good, good, good. So we got to dig into the crude oil market. I need to pick your brain for about a half hour or so. We've seen oil volatility sort of collapse to the year's lows below 30, and we just saw oil bounce from $70 to $80. What do you think are the driving forces right now, and what kind of prognosis do you have for the oil market?
Generally speaking, we have many issues that's been settled in the market. Now, let's keep the Houthis and the Red Sea issues on the side for now.
Yeah.
If you look at 2022 and the invasion of Ukraine by Russia, then we have too many things that we did not know about. And people were wondering whether Russian oil production is going to decline significantly, what will be the reaction of Europe and the United States, what will OPEC or the rest of OPEC Plus members will do, what will be the reaction of Saudi Arabia? Will the Biden administration use the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, the SPR, or not? So we have all these issues. In addition, we have the recovery. We have the lockdowns. We have the lockdowns in China. So we have all those issues in 2022, and we are coming out of all of them. So that stability, relative stability, or the decline in volatility, basically what the result of that high volatility at those times. Then OPEC Plus decided to go for voluntary cuts. Voluntary cuts, by the way, the market at the beginning was kind of skeptical of the word voluntary. But the market and market participants have to learn that from now on, voluntary cuts, forget about the word voluntary. They are just like any other cut. And they establish credibility on this. So don't hang on the word voluntary. It's just the idea here. You are not getting consensus from OPEC Plus on it. That's what it is. But it is a real cut. So the result of all of this basically is lower volatility. We've seen some volatility from the Red Sea. People were wondering why we are still at 80, why prices are not going to 100, 120. People have to realize the following. In September 2019, we lost 5.5 million barrels a day from Saudi Aramco when Saudi Aramco was attacked. 5.5 million, that's an actual loss. Yet prices went up by about $20, and that's it, and for a short period of time. Now we are not losing oil. We are just diverting oil, so it's going to arrive late. So why do you expect prices will go up by $20, $25, and we have no loss in the first place? The impact is just the delay. And once we reach kind of the new normal where all the delays basically are built in, then we have no problem. So that's where we are getting that some sort of lower volatility or semi kind of stability in a sense because of these things.
Okay, let's talk about, I see you paint a really clear picture of a lot of things that the oil market is facing. I want to ask you one question that's kind of direct related to what you said. And it's, you know, we just saw the Houthi rebels literally just kill three crew members of a Barbados flagged Liberian owned carrier. So it wasn't a U.S. ship. But, you know, this is, sounds like it's getting more serious in the Gulf of Aden. Like we've got an actual body count now, and the crude oil market is totally discounting any sort of escalation of events. tell me, Dr. Anas, what? How do you look at the Houthi rebels? And I just want to say personally, I just have to throw in the caveat that they're a very weird organization to me because they're the first organization that I've ever seen around the world that has a lot of power and no leader and no spokesperson, right? They just do damage and we blame the Houthi rebels and then we look at the markets and see if everything's okay and we proceed. Can I ask your take on that, sir?
Yes. We cannot take a partial story here and just talk about partial of it. I have to mention the whole story. By
sure,
the way,
they do.
They do have a spokesman who is, in a sense, popular and well-known face to the media. So they do have a spokesman.
I haven't seen that person. Okay.
First, we did more spaces and coverage of the Houthis from A to Z and the impact on the oil market than anyone else. Okay. And all those spaces and all those write-ups and all the podcasts, basically, people can find them on my Twitter feed or others.
Fantastic.
But we did bring in one of the top experts in the world on Houthis, and we had 2-hour conversation on this, and it is recorded. People can go back to that.
I will definitely listen to that. What are the Cliff's Notes? What's the short story?
Well, the short story basically is the Houthis and whatever they are doing has nothing to do with Gaza, as they claim. They are an organization that can survive on literally volatility. They can survive on no war, no peace. And the only way they can influence others to gain any bargaining power in any negotiations is to cause trouble. So a peace in Gaza basically is a death sentence for them in a sense. So they are not interested in a peace in Gaza. They don't want to their efforts to lead to a peace in Gaza because they have nothing on the table to offer except trouble.
Right.
So today we have a segment in our daily energy report on this. And last week we had a segment basically. And the question is, if we end up with a peace in Gaza, what would the Houthis do? If they stop, then we can believe them that they did it because of Gaza. But if they did not, if they don't stop, look, they've been causing trouble even before Gaza. They've been sending rockets to Saudi Arabia 3-4 years ago. So let's go back and look at the whole story here because I think it is an important story.
Sure.
People have to realize that the hottest region in the world in the last 2 years is the Red Sea. Literally the hottest. Is why. We have the sanctions imposed on Russia after the invasion of Ukraine. Now Russian oil cannot go to Europe. It has to go to Asia. There are two ways to go to Asia. They can send it from the northeast, the Sakhalin area and all that stuff. They can send it to Asia. There is no problem there. But all the other oil that has to go through the Mediterranean, the Suez Canal, the Red Sea. So Russian exports to Asia increased from about 250,000 barrels a day before the invasion to 1.7 million barrels a day through the Suez Canal and the Red Sea. Now Europe does not have the oil. It needs the oil. Now Gulf states have to reroute their oil from Asia to Europe. So we have more oil going north in the Red Sea than before. So we have more oil coming south, more oil going north. At the same time, they needed the gas. They needed liquefied natural gas. They need gas from Qatar. They need gas from Oman, UAE, or any other country in the area. So we have more LNG going through the Red Sea. At the same time, U.S. oil production went through the roof. And they start sending it, well, they've been sending it to Asia, but the amount going to Asia increased. And it has to go through the Red Sea.
And then we have massive traffic increase. Got it.
And then we have the U.S. LNG and the boom in LNG. And that has to go through the Red Sea. Take all of that, and now let's talk about China. China basically is getting all the minerals and all the metals from Africa for the green revolution, for the green whatever, green transition, energy transition. And some of those metals have to go through the Red Sea. At the same time, China has to export all the solar panels. It has to export the parts for all the wind turbines, and it has to export the batteries for EVs, for electric vehicles. And now it is exporting a large number of electric vehicles and all of this through the Red Sea. So even before Gaza, even before the Houthis, the Red Sea was the hottest area in the world. That led to record revenues of the Suez Canal. Literally record revenues, the highest revenues ever for the Suez, was for the Suez Canal, which is started from 1890, by the way. So this is a long history. The highest ever was in 2023. So if you are the United States or the UK and looking at the world and looking at the Red Sea, what do? You want control. Regardless of Gaza, regardless of the Houthis. The Houthis basically were the useful idiots who brought in those forces to the Red Sea. Notice this. Saudi Arabia objected to the existence of these forces in the Red Sea. Egypt refused or rejected to participate in this in these events. And both of them basically on both sides of the Red Sea. So people in the region do not want the US to be there. They don't want the UK to be there. So what they are doing there? The Houthis are a very small, tiny group that can be destroyed easily by the US or the UK. The US and the UK went to the Red Sea under the pretext that we are going to stop the Houthis from affecting shipping lanes. Well, we are 3-4 months later. Look what happened.
Right.
Okay. So now we have this diversion of all kinds of ships and tankers, including LNG, around Africa. And insurance rates for ships going through the Red Sea went through the roof. It wasn't only the insurance rates. Workers, those who work on ships, the sailors basically, are refusing to go. And there is a mutiny on some of those ships. And what some companies did, they literally doubled and tripled their salaries. So just to go. So the cost went through the roof because of that. However, Russia still sent its crude through the Red Sea. The Saudis came to the rescue of the world because they have those pipelines coming from the east to the west, to the middle of the Red Sea. So they have a big port, or basically two ports there. So they are able to export the oil to Europe, and the oil exports to Europe increased substantially, by the way, without going through Bab al-Mandeb or the southern part of the Red Sea where the Houthis are. So they can still use those pipelines to the ports and literally ship to Europe. So they came to the rescue. And this is really not appreciated by the media today, and no one is talking about it, while literally without those pipelines, and this is one of the ironies, the historic ironies in the oil industry. Those oil pipelines were built in the 80s to avoid the Hormuz Strait. They were built to avoid problems there. And now, the most benefits we got of those pipelines because of Bab al-Mandeb Strait.
Good grief, Dr. Anas. This is a complicated story, huh? I'm glad I asked the question. Wow. Really amazing. What do we think, though? What do we think from here? You know, the physical markets have tightened up a little bit. At least the exchange spreads have, right? You know, the front month WTI spread has gone from slightly contango or flat to about 50 cents backwardated now. The rest of the spreads are tightening up. I mean, it seems like, you know, the global demand for oil and gas is extremely healthy. Would you agree? And do you think that's sustainable? Do you think where do you think the risk is right now in the oil market?
I don't think the demand is healthy. I think the demand remains weak. We have to distinguish between two things here. We have to distinguish between consumption and demand. Because if China's imports are going up, people get fooled and say, well, imports are going up. That means the Chinese economy is going up. Well, they are storing the stuff. And if they are storing it, that means the economy is not as strong as imports indicate. So what we've seen recent months, since last August until now, exactly as we expected, by the way, the Chinese released 90 million barrels from their inventories. 90 million. Which means that they need to refill. If they need to refill, then their imports will go up. And people would think, oh, it's a strong economy. No, they are refilling their SPR. They are refilling their inventories. And in China, by the way, it's very hard to distinguish between the SPR and commercial inventories because they are, most of them are government companies anyway. And even those private companies, who's going to say no to the government?
Right.
So in a sense, everything is SPR, if you got to look at it that way. So the issue is, I think that we have kind of still lackluster oil demand. Our number for the year basically is 1.48 million barrels a day, very close to what the International Energy Agency basically is saying, what WoodMac and OPEC basically are saying, 2.2. I think that's a need. We need more evidence to show that we have that demand that is that strong. We believe that prices are, without any major political event where we lose capacity. And I did not say I'm talking about capacity, production capacity.
Yeah. Right.
Prices will be range bound throughout the year, and it is very hard to see oil prices reaching 100 without a major political event that leads to loss of capacity.
That's fair. That's fair. I think that's what the markets have been telegraphing. That's what I think price action is saying, that oil is probably well balanced between, you know, 75 and 80 or 75 and 85 or something like that. And the markets seem to be in okay shape. Do you think there's what are your thoughts on the equities, you know, either exploration and production, oil services, refiners? You know, it's fun to see Marathon Petroleum soaring to all-time highs. It looks like Bitcoin all of a sudden. What do you think's behind that, Dr. Anas?
Generally speaking, I mean, we're talking about prices 75 to 80. And there was this conviction among certain groups that's not enough for shale. This is not correct. I am bullish on equities in general, including especially the Canadians. At 75 to 80, those companies can do extremely well. If there is a company not doing well, it either has a bad acquisition or something awfully wrong going on, which means that you don't want to be near it anyway because of these problems. But generally speaking, when you talk about $75 to $80 oil, those companies can do extremely well.
Yeah.
Here's the problem, Tony.
Yeah.
You know that the natural gas market is in really bad shape. It is in trouble. Prices are very low. People have to realize that natural gas prices are low because of the massive amount of gas or associated gas that comes with oil. So it is really the additions from the Permian and other places where they produce natural gas with oil. And the problem we've seen recently is we've seen some of the biggest companies in the natural gas sector cutting production. Will that solve the problem? Well, if oil prices are going up and if we are going to go to 85 and 90, look, this is going to last for a long time. And the reason why, because at 80 and 85, the Permian and others are going to produce more oil than ever, and they are going to bring in massive amount of gas. And what we've seen in the last 3 months, and this is like goes in cycles, as companies branch out to new areas or new zones, sometimes they encounter gassier areas or gassier zones. So the classification is still an oil well. They are still producing oil. They make their oil on the 80 and 85, or they make their money on the oil at $80 and $85 and dump that gas on the market at any price, even negative. And that's a big problem here. So the issue is that higher oil prices is a crisis for the natural gas market.
Right. So what do you, I mean, I guess the, do you, I don't want to take words out of your mouth. Does natural gas continue heading south? Like, do we head towards a dollar or get closer to a dollar? What do you think?
It's very hard to say, but it is very clear that the bottom probably is 105, 110.
Yeah.
That's the bottom for natural gas, because that's where companies start cutting production, as we've seen. But the issue here is this, that some companies have no choice but to sell at a negative price if they want to continue producing oil. They have no choice. So we will see negative prices in some areas. On the other side, this is good for LNG. So LNG companies and those who sign contracts with them, they are going to benefit greatly from this. This raises a very interesting question in this year of elections. We've seen the Republicans in Congress voting for banning the sale of SPR to China, which is a complete nonsense anyway. I mean, why you guys are wasting time? China can get the oil in one way or the other. This is not a big deal. That SPR is going to displace some oil that China can buy. So it's not going to be direct. That's fine. But what people have to realize in this year of election that America is depleting its resources. And I'm talking literally about Canada and China here. Canada and the United States. They are depleting their resources while China is buying this gas and LNG, buying the oil, storing it. They are discovering, they have new discoveries of oil and gas. But what we are noticing is they are not developing them. And because they are not developing them now, this gives us the idea, hold on a second. It looks like America is depleting its resources. China is buying it on the cheap. And if something, if a war breaks out in the next 100 years or whenever, they can develop their own resources while the U.S. and others may not have those resources. So this kind of very interesting development where the U.S. is U.S. producers are developing everything they can develop while China is finding out new oil and gas, but they are not developing them.
And they're sitting on it for future use. I would imagine that is really interesting. Dr. Anas, while we're on this sort of, you know, this really global topic right now, I love your perspective on this. This is really beyond anything I'm able to put together. So I love listening to you speak about it. Can I ask you what your thoughts are about the BRIC countries trying to trade commodities in, you know, non-dollar currencies? Do you have a strong view on that, or do you see that affecting the energy markets, or do you see that playing into the energy markets at all, or do you just have a view on what's going on with, you know, Russia and Brazil and India starting to trade in non-dollar currency?
And I do have very strong views.
Oh, I'd love to hear this.
And we've written several reports, and we dedicated several podcasts and spaces for it. And one of the reasons I just want to clarify, this is important for the audience to know. In my PhD dissertation, I talked about the oil market and OPEC behavior. But I was the first one to talk about the impact of exchange rates on the oil market. So this is in the heart of it. And that's why I am heavily involved in this discussion. First of all, whatever BRICS wants to do, they cannot do one thing, which is oil is priced in U.S. dollars and will continue to be priced in U.S. dollar, no matter what. Why? Because we distinguish between the pricing on one hand and getting revenues in non-dollar on the other. These are completely two different things. Until today, oil is priced in U.S. dollar. Now, someone might say, well, look at China. They have that Shanghai exchange and they sell their oil in yuan. Well, we've done our research, and our research was confirmed by CME, by the way, that the price in China in yuan is exactly the dollar price in Dubai, given the time difference and the quality differential. So it's a mirror image. So you are literally trading the exchange rates, and that's it. There is no pricing in yuan that is completely independent on its own. So this is a fact of life. Oil is priced in dollar, will continue to be priced in U.S. dollar. Given the fact that the U.S. is the largest producer in the world of oil, it had the largest market in the world, and it is the third largest exporter of oil in the world, oil will remain priced in U.S. dollar because the U.S. is not going to use any other currency anyway.
Right.
That's number one. Number two, on the revenues.
Yeah.
Countries, long time ago, countries are free to get revenues in any currency they want. Even if they get dollars, they can go and exchange it. But what happened in recent years is that the U.S. imposed sanctions on so many countries, and because those countries were not able to use SWIFT, or they cannot use financial transactions, or they want to hide their transactions. So they shied away because they wanted something else. I challenge anyone to show me a country voluntarily shied away from the dollar. For nothing, just pure markets, pure economic. There is not. Oh, yeah. All the countries that are shying away from the dollar, there are some sort of sanctions or trade war that involved in there. And I've done a lot of field work in several areas on oil smuggling. And if you go to those smugglers, and some of them are criminals, by the way, you go to those guys and put all currencies in front of them on the table and tell them to pick up the price or to pick up the revenues or whatever the thing they are selling. And tell them, okay, you know, pick up the currency you want. Here's the money. They will pick up the dollar.
Every time.
Every time. Except in some areas, in Turkey and Eastern Europe and Russia. They want euro because that's where most of their trade is. But still a euro. Still not the Chinese yuan, not any others.
Right.
And those who are talking about the penetration of the Chinese yuan, you look at the numbers, most of the yuan is within China. It's not globally. It's not global.
Right. Right.
But here is the final thing that's kind of very interesting when it comes to those currencies. Now, China is signing all kind of deals, and the Indians are trying to ask their customers, look, take my rubies, take this. There are many stories out there in the media that are absolutely either kind of biased or completely incorrect.
Mm.
Okay. So when we look in, at cases like in India, for example, Indian companies paid in U.S. dollar, paid the Russians in U.S. dollar. Iranians today, they are getting revenues from Iraq in U.S. dollars. So let's not discount those stories. And someone will say, well, India traded with the UAE in Indian rupees. Yes, it was one experimental shipment, one.
Mm-hmm.
And the UAE has 4 million Indian expatriates. And the UAE is one of the largest exchange markets in the world, which means that you go to the UAE, you go to Dubai, exchange places are all over the place. Indians are all over the place. And Indians would rather do the exchange in the UAE, not in India. So it is to the benefit of the UAE to get the rubies, and it's not the other way.
Right.
So the idea here is, if you look at all the numbers, at all the things, etc., we cannot even use Bitcoin. I think that we have an article on the use of Bitcoin. And there are three characteristics that need to exist to use a currency for oil and replace the dollar. The first one is you need a globally accepted currency. Okay, nothing matches the dollar. Euro is close, but nothing else. You need something that is a kind of less volatile than others. Look, the Chinese are able to control their currency through government orders, not through free markets.
Right.
But the dollar, basically, relative to all others, is more stable. And in addition to all of these, we need a currency. As I said, it's widely accepted. It has lower volatility, and literally you can buy things with it, whatever you want, and that's really part of the acceptance of the dollar. Other substitutes do not work, because many people said, well, we can use a basket of currencies. Well, even with a basket of currencies, the dollar is going to take the big chunk anyway because of the global trade. And with the currency, for example, you have other problems because you have to manage the currency as exchange rates change every day and every month, etc. And that's very costly. So it's not going to work. And people have to realize that pricing oil in dollar or any single currency had the same exact disadvantages. So pick up any other currency, it's the same problem.
Man, that is a great, great argument, Dr. Anas. And I cheated because I listened to one of the spaces that you were on discussing the non-dollar currency trading, and I really enjoyed it. So that's why I asked that question. So that was really, really enlightening to listen to as well. Do you have a view on the dollar directionally, dollar index, since we're just talking about it right now?
Not really. No. We have a case. Because generally speaking, our focus, as you know, is on energy. So
yeah,
we shy away from macro, although I taught macro for 20 years.
But, right.
The issue here is we think that U.S. oil exports maxed out. Mm-hmm. If we keep going on oil exports, let's say we go to 7 million instead of 5 million, mm-hmm. then there is a case basically to support the dollar and keep going up for a long time. But now we are seeing limitation to U.S. Exports.
Got it. No, that's totally fair and totally a great answer. Do you have any views, Dr. Anas, on any sort of non-fossil fuel energy, like, uranium, for example? Do you have a view on that, that the nuclear sector is kind of perking up? And I just thought I'd ask.
Yes, we had a 2.5 hour space the other day, and it is on our Substack, and it is on our Twitter accounts and all this stuff. Basically, we went into depth into this. We have top experts on this topic, and we are very bullish on uranium. We are very bullish on nuclear in general. So the story, the bottom line here is all of a sudden we have countries that all of a sudden they wake up and they realize that all this talk about solar and wind that they've been talking about in the last 7-8 years does not make any sense because they cannot achieve any of their goals without nuclear. So we've seen a comeback from all sides. At the same time, we are seeing countries, like especially in the Arab world, you are talking about the UAE already have their own 3 reactors. They started the last one recently. Saudi Arabia is working on developing nuclear reactors, or at least installing them instead of developing them. We have Algeria is thinking about it. We have Egypt is already in the process of building one. The Russians are building one for Egypt. You look at Morocco, they are working their legal issues right now. Turkey, they are going to finish the first station soon, and they already signed a contract for the second one, and they are talking about the third one. So even when you look at the Middle East in general, we are seeing kind of a renaissance of nuclear, even in those countries. So we are bullish on uranium.
Ugh. Brilliant, Dr. Anas. This is brilliant. I can't thank you enough. I want to say we I think we've kind of covered everything full circle in this sort of direction that I want to cover it. Is there anything that we didn't talk about today that has been a hot topic for you discussing with your client that I missed?
It is very important for everyone in the market to realize this fact. We have several news items that appeared in the last 2-3 months talking about how Europe succeeded in avoiding crisis in the absence of Russian gas, and how their renewable energy and their policy succeeded, and how they were able to lower emissions. This is completely nonsense. And here is why. And this is what people need to pay attention to. When you have a recession or low economic growth, the sun will rise anyway. And therefore, you are going to have your solar power no matter what. And wind will blow whether you have a recession or you don't. Managers, utility managers, they have control only of coal, natural gas, and oil. That's what they can control. And therefore, when you have recessions or low economic growth and your demand for electricity is declining, what you do? You do what you can control. What you can control is natural gas, coal, and oil. And therefore, you control those. As a result, the proportion of renewable energy in your energy mix increases. And therefore, your emissions decreases. That's the story. It has nothing to do with government policy. Right. Now, what will happen next is, once the European economy are growing, let's say, at 3%, the sun will continue to rise, wind will continue to blow at the same level. That's it. So how you are going to meet the energy demand? You have to go back and bring in those oil and coal and natural gas back. And therefore, their proportion in the pie is going to increase. Emission increases again. So those stories in the media are not only biased, basically, they are ignoring the macro situation in Europe. And that's why we are still bullish on coal, bullish on gas, and bullish on oil.
Oh, tremendous. Well, that is the perfect way for us to round out this conversation, Dr. Anas. That was an outstanding review of the European situation and the breakdown of the fossil fuels versus renewables. My God, we covered the conflict and the situation in the Red Sea. We covered the Houthi rebels. We covered consumption versus demand. We covered that you're bullish E&P companies. We talked about natural gas and even your view on the non-dollar currency commodity trading. and your command of the sort of global, political, fundamental energy situation is better than anybody that I've ever spoken to. So I'm really, really grateful. I really am grateful for you to take the time today, Dr. Anas. That was an outstanding roundup. Tell us where, real quick, where our listeners can find you.
Yeah. We published a daily energy report, and it's really cheap relative to everything else. And we published the EOE Energy Outlook Advisors newsletter too. So these are two separate publications. The link to them is in my bio on my Twitter account or X account. People can go there. I am very active on Twitter because when I do multitasking, Twitter is my left hand.
Exactly.
I tweet while I'm working. Twitter, I do have a website, which is anasalhaji.com, anasalhaji.com. And of course, our website, energyoutlookadvisors.com. But the best basically to do is to follow us on Substack and Twitter.
Oh, that was perfect. Dr. Anas, I can't thank you enough for taking some time out. That was the most outstanding roundup we've had in a while. We're going to put all the links and places to contact you when we post this interview up on the website. And once again, thank you so much for joining me. I can't thank you enough for taking the time today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
This episode of the Oil Ground Up with Tony Greer should not be perceived as investment advice. Tony, his guests here on the Oil Ground Up, and the host company Clear Commodity Network are not responsible for any losses arising from any investment decisions based on the information presented. Please do your own research and speak with a licensed financial representative before making any investment decisions.